This is The Europeans, and we are live in front of an audience across Europe. Hi, everyone.
Hello, everyone watching us live. Let's see if I can still talk whilst being watched by people. It's really a different thing. I should clarify, we're not actually live in front of people. For the people who are listening at home, we're actually on Zoom with an audience of people all across the world who support the podcast, but it's still very exciting. And I think we can now say it's kind of become a yearly tradition.
Yeah, this is actually the third year in a row that we've done this. And we're also joined by our lovely producers, Kat Laszlo in Amsterdam and Wojciech Aleksiak in Warsaw. Hi, guys.
Hi. Hello, everyone.
And as usual, we are here in our ugliest Christmas jumpers with some appropriate festive snacks local to our respective countries. And I've actually got some pepillotes here, these little chocolates in France that come with a little, like a riddle or a quiz or something. And I actually just opened one, and it's quite a good question for you all. Qui apporte les cadeaux de Noël en Suède? Who brings Christmas presents in Sweden? Is it A, Father Christmas, B, a gnome, C, St. Nicholas, or D, a fairy? Any ideas?
No.
I want it to be a gnome.
Adrian says B.
Adrian says B. Correct. It is a gnome.
Oh, yay. I did not know that.
Educational snack I've got. What's everyone else eating?
You've done so much better than me with your Christmas snack. I did make a tiramisu, which is not Christmassy at all, but I've been really sick this week and it's my favourite food in the world, so I decided to treat myself, even if it has nothing to do with Christmas.
Good for you. That's what this time of year is all about, treating yourself. Wojciech, what are you eating?
I'm not eating, I'm drinking. I'm sipping winter tea that was created, it was prepared by my niece, and it's really glorious. It has cloves, oranges, and I guess it's ginger. It's really great.
Yum. Mm,
lekker.
And Kat, what have you got?
So I just surfaced from a retreat, so I'm feeling a bit thin-skinned, and I just ran to the supermarket to the Lidl section, and these are some festive looking truffles. So a bit of a capitalist answer for me, but that's my shortcut.
Lidl is the best at this time of year.
And I have a khaki fruit, which apparently I did last year too, but I just think it's so cool, especially if you go to Italy or a country where they actually grow, and there's just like this naked tree with only khaki fruits on it. So yeah, annual tradition.
Well, all of these snacks sound delicious. Please do try and keep your disgusting chewing noises to a minimum while your microphones are on. This is not an ASMR podcast. Dominic, what's coming up this week? Because I think a lot of people are probably expecting a quite intense political debrief, given the crazy turn of events in the Romanian elections and the fall of my government here in France. But we've decided to put our heads in the sand for this final festive episode of the year, haven't we?
Yes, we have. Sorry, everyone. We're taking the liberty of pretending that there isn't a huge amount of breaking news in Europe and the wider world right now. And we're going to be talking about something that is absolutely not breaking news. At this time of year in Europe, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Europeans will be dipping into icy water during the winter holidays, sometimes in Santa outfits, sometimes just in a regular bathing suit. So we're using this festive episode as an excuse to talk about the practice of cold water swimming, something we've been wanting to discuss on the show for ages. It's a tradition that goes back centuries, especially in the northern, colder half of Europe. And it's definitely not something that is just for the festive period, because for many people, it's a very important part of their routine. We're going to be joined later in the show by theatre and radio documentary maker and professor of audio storytelling, Katarina Smets, to talk about why she and so many other people keep plunging into the icy water. That's coming up later on in the show. But first, of course, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week. Wojciech, hit the jingle. Good Week, Bad Week. So, Katie, who are you giving your festive Good Week to?
I'm going to give a qualified Good Week to a policy initiative by the Greek government designed to make the holiday season a little bit less punishing on Greek people's bank balances at a time when the cost of living has been a massive problem for many, many people. This is a policy called the household basket. Do you know what that is?
No, I do not.
So it was introduced in late 2022, around about the time when inflation had been really starting to soar internationally, in part because of rising energy costs due to the war in Ukraine. And in Greece, the rise in food costs was particularly staggering. Basic things like olive oil and milk were going up like 25% in a year. It was incredibly difficult for people on low incomes. So what the Greek government did was it made a deal with the supermarket chains to sell a bunch of different food products, 31 different types of food, everything from milk to pasta, at fixed prices.
So do you mean that the government subsidized these products?
No, that's what makes this interesting, I think. This is not the government coming in saying to the supermarkets, you know, please can you make these products cheaper for customers and we will pay you the difference. It's not a subsidy. What they did was they got representatives of the supermarkets around a table and they made them all agree on fixed prices for all of these products.
Sounds like quite a good idea, but the thing I find confusing about this is, don't supermarkets make things as cheap as possible anyway because they're in competition with each other? Like, why is this necessary?
Well, you know, yes, in an ideal capitalist world, you would have super fierce competition between supermarket chains and they would make hardly any profit because they'd all be pricing their foods as cheaply as possible in the fight for customers, right? And it's true that supermarket chains traditionally operate on pretty slim profit margins, and they make their money mostly just from selling things in huge, huge volumes. However, there is some evidence that supermarket companies around the world increased their profit margins during COVID and the cost of living crisis that followed. And that to some extent, they were telling their customers, yeah, you know, it's awful, isn't it? We really, really hate putting our prices up. But unfortunately, you know, with all of these supply chain problems that we've been having, we just haven't got any choice. And then actually, they were sneakily putting up their prices that little bit more than they needed to and blaming it on the crisis. We know that this happened in various countries like Australia and the US. In Greece, interestingly, they actually put in legislation in 2022 to put a cap on the size of the profit margins that supermarkets could make to stop them profiteering from the crisis in this way. And 9 supermarkets are currently under investigation for making more profits recently than they're legally allowed to. All of this is to say that capitalism doesn't work perfectly. I don't know if you noticed. And there is some stuff that you can do as a government to try and make supermarket prices less eye-wateringly expensive. Mm-hmm. So the Greek government did 2 things. Firstly, it put this cap on the supermarket's profit margins, although the fact that several chains are under investigation for making too much profit suggests that that policy hasn't been working perfectly. And then they did this price-fixing thing. Now, normally when companies get together and agree to fix prices, that is bad. It's called forming a cartel. And as a strategy, the goal is to make as much money as possible for their companies. But in this case, the supermarkets agreed to fix the prices at below the market rates. So it's a nice friendly cartel. And in each of these food categories, the supermarkets had to have at least 1 product on sale for the fixed price or they would get fined. This thing was heavily aimed at making life easier for the poorest shoppers, quite rightly, I think, in a country with some of the lowest average wages in the EU. And there were some gripes from more middle-class shoppers that this wasn't really helpful for anyone who wasn't really on the very, very lowest incomes. Because the supermarkets have often been taking items from, you know, their budget ranges and applying the special prices to these often lower quality items. Nevertheless, you know, this shopping basket policy was only supposed to last a year, but the government ended up continuing with it since the cost of living crisis sadly seems to be here to stay. And that is where my bit of festive good news comes in.
Oh, good. I was wondering when it was going to become Christmassy.
It's here. The Greek government has just launched its household basket Christmas 2024 edition. They brought the supermarket chains back to the negotiating table and they have agreed on fixed prices for 6 more categories of foods that tend to get eaten a lot in Greece over the holidays. And according to the development ministry, the prices in most cases will be the same as last year or actually lower.
Oh, well, this sounds very nice. What are the foods that they've added?
Chocolate, you'll be glad to hear.
Great.
But also a lot of things that you might find on Greek tables around this time of year that you might not be so familiar with if you're not Greek. Vasilopita, for example, which is a delicious, gooey, orangey cake eaten for the new year. Tsoureki, which is this very beautiful, light, sweet bread with orange zest in it, also eaten in the holidays. And also goat meat, along with lamb and turkey. So there you are. As of Wednesday, December 11th, if you go to a Greek supermarket, you will find items from all of these categories at fixed prices. And they will stay at those prices until January the 3rd. And, you know, fine, maybe a lot of Greeks on slightly higher incomes don't find this policy to be that helpful to them. But those on the lowest incomes presumably do. And that's really important, especially at a time of year when money worries are often really high, but there's also lots of social obligations to be festive and act like there's plenty to go around when there isn't.
Mm. You said at the beginning that this was a qualified good week, like I think you do almost every week now, and I think you need to get out of the habit of it.
Not just me.
But why is it qualified? Were you just like feeling like hedging your bets?
I think it's just that like a lot of Greeks have complained that this policy isn't enough, given how bad the cost of living crisis has been, that it feels like a bit of a sticking plaster over a gaping wound. Like a lot of critics have said, you know, if you really care about making food more affordable, why don't you cut the tax on food, for example? So I don't want to make it sound like the Greek government has fixed everything with this policy and that I'm their biggest fan. But I do think this policy probably does more good than harm. And actually, I wanted to ask you, if they introduce this in the Netherlands, what festive food items would you like your government to arrange fixed prices for?
Ooh. I think my favorite thing to eat around Christmas is Brussels sprouts, actually.
Oh, so, unusual answer. No one says that.
Yeah, I know it's a controversial vegetable and some people hate them, but I think they're great.
I like a sprout.
They're in season right now, so it would make sense to do it now. I might persuade people to eat a bit less meat.
Mm.
Controversial. What about you?
Good choice. Well, there is one thing that I quite enjoy a little glass of around this time of year that I probably wouldn't have in the middle of the summer, which is a drop of the beloved Irish liqueur Baileys. Other brands of Irish cream-based aperitif are available. But I also never buy it because it's quite expensive and it's so thick and rich that we just never finish the bottle. So if the government wanted to like fix the prices of that to kind of tempt me back to the Baileys aisle of the supermarket, I wouldn't complain.
This is where I think maybe this isn't the most important thing to fix the prices of. And I think, yeah, I'm not sure the societal value in that policy. So let's move on.
I'm interested to hear whether our supporters in the audience tonight agree with me or with Dominic on this one. But yes, with this delicious thought, let's move on to bad week. Who are you giving your bad week to, Dominic?
It's been a bad week and a bad month, really, for a tree known locally as the Green Giant, a tree that was sitting in a forest called Val di Ledro in Trentino in Italy. And a few weeks ago, conservationists lost a fight to stop this very old fir tree from being chopped down and transported to Vatican City to be the centerpiece Christmas tree in St. Peter's Square. We're recording this episode on Sunday, and the tree was officially inaugurated yesterday by the Pope. I thought I'd briefly share my screen with you all so that people watching live can see a little clip of this tree.
Oh, that's a big old tree.
It is, and it's lit quite extravagantly. There's some people playing the flute.
It's a bit straggly, actually. It's one of those trees that's too tall. I quite like a short, fat tree, personally.
It's narrower than we're used to from traditional Christmas trees, but yeah, it's been a bad week for this tree, and a bad week for a significant group of locals who campaigned furiously to stop the tree from being felled and used for this purpose. The tree was chopped down a few weeks ago now, but in the run-up to the felling, a petition was started by a local conservation association. It was signed by over 50,000 people who wanted to stop their green giant from being chopped down, a tree which they say is 200 years old. They said in the petition, sign to say no to the purely consumerist practice of using living trees for ephemeral use for mere advertising purposes and a few ridiculous selfies. Saving the tree would, quote, send a strong message of reflection on the importance of valuing and respecting the role of the plant world in the anthropocentric era that sees increasingly dramatic climate irregularities.
Hmm.
They also point out that the Christmas tree is actually a pagan tradition and has absolutely nothing to do with the birth of Christ.
There is that.
And they claim that the operation to cut down and transport this tree and almost 40 other smaller trees from the area, which have been placed around the Vatican, they claim that it's costing the public purse roughly 60,000 euros, which sounds like a huge amount to me. But apparently it also includes some extra things, like they took a local band to the Vatican. Maybe those flautists we just saw were from the local area. And 500 locals were also taken, and there were some school initiatives. Yeah, so it's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. But that aside, isn't it a bit surprising that the Pope would apparently condone chopping down a beloved tree, when in generally, you know, he's not really the worst when it comes to being an advocate for the environment and the natural world, right?
Yeah, I thought that too. And it's actually an argument they make in the petition. They really appeal to the Pope's environmental side because, yeah, maybe you're aware or maybe you're not, but Pope Francis has put quite a lot of energy into spreading the message that the natural environment needs protecting since he became Pope in 2013. In 2015, he famously put out this encyclical, a 184-page document called Laudato Si, in which he laments environmental degradation and global warming whilst also criticizing consumerism. Mm. He has in the past described climate deniers as foolish and argues that richer countries have an ecological debt to poorer countries. So yeah, I can understand why the petition writers thought they might have had a chance with Pope Francis. Maybe he would sympathize with their argument and decide to find a different tree to put in front of the Vatican, or, I don't know, a living tree.
Did the Vatican respond to this petition?
They responded via the media, although I understand from the petition organizers that they actually never got a reply directly from the Vatican. Hmm. The official line from the Vatican that they put out in the media is that the 30-meter tree was not only chosen because of its aesthetic value, but they claim it was actually the ecologically responsible choice. And the Pope himself actually even referred to the ecological question in a statement in his speech during the inauguration ceremony of the tree yesterday. He said, "The majestic solemnity of the tree is striking, cut in compliance with ecological principles for the natural renewal of the forest."
Oh, well, it's fine then.
Exactly. That official Vatican line is echoed in statements that the local mayor of Ledro put out, a guy called Renato Girardi. He uses rather more colourful language about the petitioners, describing the petition as nonsense and baseless nastiness. Mm. He also makes the bold claim that the tree was not actually 200 years old, but 60 years old. And he says that it was set to be cut down anyway as part of routine forest maintenance. Maintenance that is, according to him, all in line with the European Commission's forestry certification system. And maybe it is, honestly. I haven't been able to verify that, but it doesn't mean it's the right decision. I'll come to that later. I first want to read you another quote that he said. He said, "They are ruining the Christmas festivities just for a plant. We only want to donate a fir tree. And I would like to underline, if it wasn't donated, it would end up in a sawmill."
Oh, shots fired.
Yeah, things are really getting heated. And this is where the bad week story gets a bit confusing, because we've got two diametrically opposed versions of the facts about this tree. What more could you expect from a Christmas story in 2024? Mm-hmm. And it's honestly been quite tricky to work out what's really going on. Fortunately, I managed to get in touch with the people who set up the petition to get a response for them about the Vatican's official line. I especially wanted to know what they thought about this claim that it was an ecological choice and that chopping it down was part of natural renewal. And what they said to me raises some serious doubts about the official line from the Vatican. This is original reporting for the Europeans on a Christmas tree.
I'm very impressed.
They said that the tree was actually not in the cutting plan, so it was not going to be cut down anyway, they claim. They say it was not part of the cutting plan because the tree, the green giant, was in the middle of a plain, an area of grass away from other trees.
Oh.
They even sent me a photo to prove that this tree was not in the middle of a patch with loads of other forests. So, indeed, it seems rather unlikely that there would be a need to cut it down for forest maintenance purposes, as has been claimed. Am I going too far with my tree investigation, Katie?
No, I think this is a great way to spend your weekend.
Okay, well, I'll stop talking about it in a minute, I promise. But I did also do some background chatting with Kat. Producer Kat's our resident specialist on all things forestry. I don't know if she'd want to be described as a specialist, but she's read quite a lot about trees. And she pointed me in the direction of the work of Suzanne Simard, a highly respected Canadian professor of forest ecology. And Simard is a strong advocate for just not cutting down old trees. Mm. She's spent loads of her career explaining that if you are going to cut down some of the trees, it's the youngest, not the oldest, that you should chop down. And that's because of what these elder trees are doing underneath the soil. She says, if we leave clusters of old trees, they nurture the next generation, they keep the carbon in the soil, they keep the biodiversity, they provide the seed. Mm. So if you follow that reasoning, an old tree like this would ideally not be cut down. In one of the emails I got from the association who set up the petition, they stressed the symbolism of this tree that appears in St. Peter's Square, and they suggested that cutting down this tree that was the home of birds and squirrels is a symbol of man's contempt for nature itself.
Mm, which doesn't feel that Christian.
No. And actually, things are getting even more heated because, breaking news for you, I actually received word from this local association that they have this weekend filed a legal complaint with the local public prosecutor's office.
Oh.
They are asking the judiciary to investigate whether the laws and regulations in force regarding environmental protection and the correct use of public funds were respected.
So they might be suing the Pope over this. Well, not necessarily personally, but the Vatican.
I think it's more a question for the mayor who made the decision.
Ah.
But yeah, it's got rather dramatic, and I am going to keep you posted if there are any developments in this story, because I'm quite invested now.
Well, thank you for this very thorough investigative report, Christmas tree correspondent Dominic Kramer. I mean, I think what this story brings up is the broader question of whether Christmas trees are good or bad for the environment, right? Because it's a debate that we have a lot, I think.
Yeah, it's one of those questions that is really difficult to answer. I feel like every year millions of people have this debate about whether or not they should have a fake tree or a real one. And from what I understand, that binary either or debate is a bit too simplistic. And a lot of it depends on where you get your tree from, what herbicides are used, what the land where it's farmed could otherwise be used for. So there's so much nuance, it's quite difficult to make that decision. But if you really want to dive into it, there's a great piece on the BBC News website that was published last week about the environmental impact of Christmas trees. It's not all depressing. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. I actually today put up my Christmas tree, and it's one that I have living on my balcony for the whole year. So it's a Aww. Living Christmas tree, and you can bring it in for 2 weeks of the year and then it won't drop too many of its pines. And I think that's probably the best thing you can do if you've got space for it, is to keep one alive, because then it retains the carbon. But you can also, if you don't have space to do that, or you don't want to faff around with having a tree in your garden, you can hire them, you can rent them from farms, so they'll just bring it to you for the festive season.
Mm.
What do you do, Katie? Have you got a plastic one or a real one?
I don't have a Christmas tree full stop.
Oh, fair enough.
But that's mostly because I have a 14-month-old son who would almost definitely try to eat both the tree and its decorations.
Mm.
I do quite like this rent a tree idea though, so maybe we'll do that next year. I also love the smell of Christmas trees, you know, and
me too.
It'd be sad not to have that in the house. And actually, fun fact, did you know you can buy these you know that spray you can buy for your bathroom that makes a nice smell after you've done your business? You can get ones that smell like Christmas trees. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. Well, Katie's family, if you're listening, you know what to get her for Christmas.
Just make your bathroom smell nice and festive after you've spent some time in there.
Okay, I think it's time for a jingle.
Anyway.
Thanks. Wojciech, hear the jingle.
Being able to see so many of the people here tonight who support this podcast, who have made our work possible with their generosity, it feels like a really special way to end the year. As we insist on telling you every week, the Europeans only exists because of our listeners. And the fact that we're still here 7 years later and making, I think, better podcasts about Europe than ever, that is because of you guys. It's a kind of miracle. So thank you all so, so much, both everyone who's here tonight and those of you who support the show but aren't able to join us. It's very cheesy to say it, but as the year comes to an end, I'm feeling really, really grateful for the amazing community that we've built around this podcast.
Me too. Thank you all so much.
We have a few new supporters to thank who've signed up this past week to support the Europeans by going to patreon.com/Europeans podcast and sending a few euros our way every month. And producer Wojciech, famously, whenever you're with us in front of the microphone, your greatest pleasure in life is derived from reading out the names of our latest supporters. So my Christmas gift to you is this honor. Over to you.
Thank you. I'm moved. But above all, thank you to Elisa, thank you Shayna, thank you Alexander, thank you Serafim, Alzbieta, thank you Sana, thank you Daniel, thank you Chris, thank you Agnieszka, thank you Igor, and thank you to Eddie for increasing his monthly donation. Thank you all.
It's really the most charming audio fetish of anyone on our team that you enjoy reading out the names so much.
Isn't it?
Our very big thank you goes out to everyone who supports the making of podcasts like the one you're listening to now via Patreon, but also to the many, many people who have supported the crowdfunding campaign for our new series, Who Does It Best? If you don't know what I'm talking about, go back and listen to the special announcement in our feed a few episodes ago. It's a new series we're planning for 2025 about the best, most inventive policies around Europe. And we are incredibly excited about it. We're getting tantalizingly close to our target. We've got less than 4,000 euros to go.
So close. And it would be amazing if we could make a big final push to get this last bit of crowdfunding done and dusted by the end of the year so that we can hit the ground running in January and actually start work on making this series for you. So if you would like to get us a little Christmas present, apart from my toilet spray, we would love it if you could chip in however much you can afford. Any amount, big or small, is extremely welcome. And then you get to feel like you've been part of making this podcast series happen. How cool is that?
You'll find a link to the crowdfunding campaign right there in the description of this episode and also on our website, snaking across the top of the screen. I'm doing a snaking motion with my shoulders for the people watching. Thank you so much to everyone who's contributed so far.
Thanks, everyone. It is that time of year where lots of people in various countries across this continent do something that lots of other people think is absolutely crazy. They plunge into ice-cold lakes, ponds, or the sea. In a lot of places, you'll find festive swims on Christmas Day or New Year's Day, with people often accessorizing their swimsuits with Santa hats. And sometimes it's a religious ritual too. So in January, for example, Orthodox Christians across Europe are going to be marking, as always, the Epiphany by jumping into the water, commemorating the baptism of Jesus in the River Jordan.
I'm not sure the River Jordan counts as being like an icy cold body of water.
Well, they're not going to be in the River Jordan. They're going to be in like Russia and places.
Oh, you mean people mark it where they are. Okay, sorry, I misunderstood. Yes. Scrap that.
Sorry if that wasn't clear. Anyway, we thought that this pan-European enthusiasm for cold swimming would be a fun thing to talk about in this last episode of the year. Also because it's something that's become increasingly popular in recent years because of the supposed benefits to our physical and mental health. You might have heard of this Dutch ice swimming guru, Wim Hof, for example. He actually moved to Poland so that he could live next to this freezing cold waterfall. And he has this absolutely huge online following, despite being a rather controversial character facing allegations of domestic abuse. But there's also lots of people who do this who have never heard of Wim Hof. Cold swimming is super popular, for example, with older women who live by the sea. I have to say I've taken a few dips in very cold water in my time, but it's not something that I've been thinking about getting into more regularly, if I'm being honest. I'm too much of a coward. What about you, Dominic?
Well, I actually made my husband do it this weekend twice.
Oh, did you?
And I watched him. Does that count?
You made him do it?
Yeah, well, honestly, I'm also a bit of a coward and I've done it every now and again, but I've also got a heart condition, an arrhythmia, and that's one of the health conditions where some doctors say you should be careful with cold water shocks, although weirdly, it's also something that my doctors say if my heart gets stuck in an arrhythmia, which it does sometimes, they say I should jump in cold water.
Oh, it's confusing.
So, yeah, to try and shock it. So, yeah, anyway, it means I'm a bit wary of it. But yeah, seeing as we're both clearly not experts in this, we thought for the interview this week, we would bring in our producer, Katz, who is someone who dips into cold water on the regular. Hi, Katz.
Hi, Katz.
Hi. Well, semi-regular. I go like once or twice a month through the winter.
And why did you decide to become one of these brave and, in some people's opinion, completely mad people who voluntarily dunk themselves into cold water?
Well, first of all, I really love the water. I always have. It's my element. But also, like a lot of people, I'm quite sensitive to winter sadness. Christmas is always a bit of a hard time. Mm-hmm. And I struggle with some mental health stuff that can make my body feel really like in danger. And that can make the world feel like a bit of an unsafe place. And then it's really hard to shift that energy just with thoughts. And while I love doing calming things like meditation and yoga, sometimes you just want to feel like alive and scream and do something wild and free. And then I get into the water. It's just this huge catharsis that makes you feel really alive and strong. And like, if I can do this, then maybe I can do other scary, difficult things. And I also really especially like that it's really not necessarily macho. Like, often the coolest people there are these 80-year-old women who just poke a face, glide on in, and they're like way cooler than everyone else. And I love that.
That is very badass. You were saying when we were talking about this earlier that it's interesting that today cold swimming seems like a kind of trendy, almost hipster thing because it's something that Europeans have been doing for hundreds of years.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about it, like warm showers and bathrooms are pretty recent. So I guess like cold plunging was kind of just the default or just never showering, I don't know. But there is also a really rich history of Europeans doing this as a ritual. Dominic and I live in the Netherlands, and here the New Year's swim is huge on New Year's Day. But in preparation for the show, I actually called people in Scotland, in Ireland, in Finland, all saying that New Year's swims or Christmas swims were big there too. I even spoke to the incredible Joyce McIntosh, who is the life president of Ye Amphibious Ancients Bathing Association.
That's amazing.
It's an amazing name for a club.
Incredible. And what's even more amazing is this organization has existed since 1884.
Wow.
Yeah. But I don't think it's that surprising. Like, it makes you feel amazing in just a couple of minutes. So yeah, I get it.
Yeah, I know that in the UK, a lot of people do a Christmas Day or Boxing Day dip. And honestly, when I was growing up, I used to think these people were a bit mad. I remember hearing from a friend who had to break the ice before dipping into Hampstead Heath ponds one Christmas Day. But I've gradually become more and more intrigued by this practice as it becomes more and more popular. It's kind of sort of treated as like an alternative health craze, but there's also like a bunch of scientific evidence that shows that it's good for our health, right?
Yeah.
Can you, as our resident scientist, Katz, like unpick some of the science around cold water swimming?
I sometimes get scared when you call me a scientist because
I've already called you our resident forestry expert.
I do have a science background, but let's just everybody chill out.
She's collecting degrees this evening.
Yeah. No, but it was actually, I've read a bit about it in the past, but it was really fun to delve into the research for this show. There are actually some really big studies going on right now, also into, you know, the mechanisms going on in our cells. Most of the studies published so far are based on self-reported impacts. So like people describing how cold swimming makes them feel. Mm. But that's actually true for a lot of really commonly used medication, like antidepressants or painkillers. That's also how those studies are done. That does mean we don't totally know how and why cold swimming works for our health. And we also don't know if it works for everyone. But there are things that we do know. The clearest thing is that it releases the cold shock you feel, releases a huge amount of dopamine and adrenaline. That's really easy to measure. And that lines up with the most common thing that people bring up, mental health. There are also studies where people who have been on antidepressants, even people who've been on them for decades, could reduce their dose within a few weeks and could even go off them after a couple of months, which is pretty impressive.
Wow.
Yeah, like even if that doesn't work for everyone, it's incredible that it works for some people, especially because antidepressants are famously not that effective for lots of people and have a lot of side effects. Another group that it is really popular with are people who struggle with addiction. And the really cool thing is that it gives you this big rush, like a replacement rush for a more unhealthy addiction. But it doesn't have the come down, like the crash. That's so hard to find, like with alcohol or with antidepressants or with most drugs.
Sugar.
Yeah, sugar, it usually the rush comes with the come down. And this is a rush that does not have that. So that is a big hack.
Okay, so mental health, check. Anything else?
The biggest thing that blew me away while I was reading over the past week was it seems to have really promising potential for Alzheimer's, both preventatively and people who are already struggling with dementia. During the cold shock, a protein is released in your brain called RBM3. And that is something that really drops in people who have Alzheimer's. And the studies are really promising. Like, people are really seeing substantial memory improvements.
Wow.
Yeah, which is really hopeful. And kind of insanely, there was a study with mice with Alzheimer's, and all of the mice were cured.
Wow. That's crazy.
Which is, you know, obviously humans are not mice, but that's an incredible success rate. So I thought that was exciting.
Yeah, it sounds really exciting.
All right, next up. Menopause, menstruation, chronic pain stuff like arthritis, rheumatism, those are all really helped with cold water swimming as well. We already talked a bit about how it's mostly older women doing this, but studies show that they're actually doing it because it helps them so much with menopause symptoms and perimenopause and menstruation. I found that especially cool because science has just really failed women in helping us manage basically everything to do with our wombs and pain.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's just like a bunch of rock star older ladies who have found something that works. It's free. They're doing it together and they just don't need to rely on this medical system that often doesn't take them seriously.
I mean, I'm starting to feel like cold swimming is some kind of magical cure-all.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also should probably shut up now and invite our guest on. But the last thing I'll say is it also decreases respiratory infections by 40%. And there's some really promising evidence on boosting energy levels for people struggling with things like long COVID, MS, also things that don't really have very good cures so far.
Are there any downsides to doing this?
So the main risk is what Dominic was describing for heart patients. It's definitely a good idea to be extra cautious if you have a higher risk of heart attacks or arrhythmia. Mm. The other thing is that staying in too long is definitely not a good idea. There's a real risk of hypothermia. The good news is that longer isn't necessarily better for the health benefits anyway. Most of them are already there after 2 minutes. Mm. Outside of that, yeah, one of the coolest things about this is that it just doesn't have that many negative side effects.
Okay, I'm sort of convinced, but beyond the science of all of these benefits, I would still like to hear from somebody who does this regularly, who has found this to be helpful in their life.
Yes, absolutely. I rang a bunch of fun people around Europe, but the perfect person is our guest today, Belgian-Polish radio producer and a dear friend of mine, Katarina Smets. Katarina is a member of the biggest cold plunge club in Antwerp, and she is gracing us with her presence, even though it's her boyfriend's birthday. Happy birthday, Servaz.
Yeah, happy birthday.
Katarina.
Happy birthday.
It is so nice to have you here with us. Can you take yourself off mute?
Hi, Katarina.
Hi, everybody. That's so nice of you. I will have Servaz listen to this and he will be very happy with it.
Oh,
thank you so much.
So nice to have you here.
Yeah.
I mean, as you already know, plunging into cold water is not something that I'm that keen to do out of choice. I think for now I'm more interested in hearing about it secondhand. So paint a picture for me. What does it feel like in your body when you get into water that's, how cold is it? Like a couple of degrees above freezing, I guess?
I think it was 4 degrees this morning.
Whoa. So.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I started doing it this 2 years ago. And in the beginning, you think this can't be good. and then you get out of the water and then you feel really good and then you think, this might be good. So you just get used to it also a little bit, to that little bit of this fear, to this rush, and you start looking forward to it, which I thought was super strange, but also super fun to go through. But I think, in the beginning, it's not really very pleasant. You go in and your legs start to itch and then you have to go in and then it really takes your breath away. And then you really try to swim as quickly as possible to the other side. And like Kat said, it's actually really a dip. Someone told me you should stay in as many minutes as the temperature is. For example, 4 minutes would be right now, I think, perfect. But when it's like 1 degrees or something, you just stay in 1 minute or I think that's plenty. And you just feel really good afterwards. And also, I'm trying not to be like this Wim Hof kind of person, because I don't subscribe to that. But I just think it's a very fun thing to do. I always feel in a much better mood after I went for a swim.
You already described that it's not necessarily that pleasant at the beginning. So why did you start doing this?
Well, 2 years ago, my mom died, and it was just a very dark time. And one of my friends was already swimming regularly, and she took me with her. And also, just before, I had to clear out the place my mom was living, and I found this almost unused bathing suits, and it just broke my heart to see them, because my mom really loved being outdoors, swimming, like water really was her element. And she died of leukemia, which also means that you have to stay in a closed environment because the risk of infection is very high. And she was really very sad that she couldn't go out. So I just started wearing her bathing suits, and I thought, like, honoring her by swimming, I think she really liked that. Also, what I thought was funny is I saw elderly ladies wearing the same bathing suits as I did. So because they're really nice, like they tuck in all the right places. So they're really fun to wear. But like Katz already said, there is this club of elderly ladies who go swimming in full makeup almost. And about 2 weeks ago, I was just swimming my merry way, and on the other side of the pond, I saw a lady in the same bathing suit as I was wearing, and we were signaling to each other.
So nice.
And she was this lovely lady with white hair. And I just really liked that. I felt really part of this club. Mm. I brought my swimming cap with me. It has an old school logo with an ice bear on it. So I'm part of the Deurnese IJsberen Club, and it's a club that exists since 1922.
Wow. Incredible.
So yeah, it's also really fun to be in this club because it's so old school. It's very not hip. Yeah, there's a lot of ice bear, statues in the clubhouse, and you can get a hot cocoa or like a Duvel. I don't know if you know Duvel. It's like a pretty strong Belgian beer. So let's say the community around it is as important as a cold water swimming itself. It's a very safe space as well.
Mm.
And also when you change, you see all these old butts around you, and it's also very comforting to see these bodies that are not like the most trained or... Yeah, it's a pretty inclusive space. Yeah.
I love that. Something I find really moving about it as well is that a lot of people are doing it for solace, for something hard, like the grief you described or illness. Mm-hmm. And these are all kinds of things that are quite taboo. Like, people often suffer in silence. And my experience with cold water swimming is that people just kind of chuck it out. And then at the same time, it's also really like silly and joyful, and everyone's like, I'm cold, And that's a really nice combination. I'm wondering what you feel about your relationship to the people that you do this with.
Yeah, I don't necessarily need to talk to the people in the tent when we are changing, shivering, half naked, but you just see people around you whose bodies maybe went through stuff. You just see that somebody is going through chemotherapy, for example. And sometimes you pick up small conversations. You already mentioned all the scientific background of cold water swimming. But what really helped for me was the lifting of brain fog.
Mm.
Sometimes I could feel really like muddled and in this sadness, and because you cannot think about anything else except survival, I guess, when you were swimming in cold water. I thought that, and also I was just thinking to myself, okay, if I survive this, maybe I can survive this grief as well. I think that was a psychological thing. A little bit like you described as well, like, okay, if I can do this, I can do hard things, I guess. So these kind of things really helped.
Well, thank you so much for coming to talk to us about cold swimming today. Is there anything you'd like to add that you think might convince listeners to start doing this? Skeptical people like me and Katie. You kind of have convinced me already, actually, to be honest.
Me too.
I think you should just do whatever you like. But what I really like about it as well, and it's more like the ecological side of it, is people want to swim in nature and a lot of our waterways are polluted. So if more people have this need to go swimming outdoors, maybe we will take better care of our water. You had the same thing in Paris, of course, where we all of a sudden had to clean up the Seine. I really wanted to go cold water swimming in England. Mm-hmm. And I had this app where you could see how much shit in the water there was. And it was horrible. Mm-hmm. You can really see how much sewage there is in our natural waters. And it was an app to warn outdoor swimmers for when the water was too polluted. And I just think that that might bring a little bit of awareness, maybe, as well. There's just so much joy in it.
I love that as an extra argument for this. Okay, I am sort of tempted to give this a go. And maybe some of our listeners will be too. Kat, handing back to you, what are some practical tips for going about attempting a cold water dip for the first time?
Yes. Katarina, also at the end, feel free to add any tips that I have forgotten. But here is my small audio guide to starting this. The first one isn't that helpful. The best thing you can do is to start in the summer and just carry on getting in as the weather changes to winter, because then you grow accustomed while the temperature drops. So it'll be a lot easier for you now that you're going anyway. Take someone with you. It's fun, but it's also a lot safer. And obviously, there are all of these clubs, but you can also just ask a friend, whatever you prefer. I would say that you should start by just getting in for like 30 seconds, really short, and slowly build it up. And the good news is that it really gets a lot easier. Like within four times, you're like, whoa, this feels completely different. And I wouldn't stay in for longer than 10 minutes unless you're really, really used to it. Okay, but you have arrived at the water, you're feeling nervous, now what? It's best not to jump in if you haven't done it recently, but to just get in gradually and then just try and let the shock wash over you before you start swimming. You might tingle, it might hurt, it maybe feels a bit electric. You might gasp or lose the ability to speak. Some people describe it as feeling like you're going to die.
Oh, great.
The good thing is that that feeling only lasts for 90 seconds.
Only 90 seconds of near death.
Yeah, you'll also experience some weird relationship with time because 90 seconds feels like ages. But this is why it does all the good things it does. So the shock is also a good thing. Uh-huh. But after the 90 seconds, you break into this new level where you kind of relax and the euphoria starts to kick in and you can go for a short swim. That feels really nice, but don't stay in for too long because hypothermia also feels quite nice.
Oh!
Weird.
I would say better too short than too long. Mm. Like when you still feel good, get out.
Fully agree. You can feel a little bit dizzy afterwards because the cold blood starts moving around your body. But the main thing you'll feel is a big dopamine rush. I find it really helps if you know that you have a way of getting warm quickly. So if you don't live super close to the water and you can't immediately have a warm shower, then it's nice to have a big fluffy towel, a nice big jumper. Don't wear tights because they're super annoying to put on with wet legs. Bring a thermos with tea so you can really, you know, drink something warm to warm you up on the inside as well. And then on you go with the rest of your day, riding on that rush. Ta-da!
I always bring super warm socks with me. I start with warming up my feet. I put my like my hat on. And of course, people also go swimming in these woolen hats, which is also really funny and endearing. So yeah, I would just use your common sense and really enjoy the company and general cheer of doing that.
Thank you, Katerina, so much for joining us.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Happy swimming. It is that time in the show when Dominic and I usually talk about the latest European things that we've been enjoying watching or reading or listening to. This week, I'll spare you the crappy Netflix Christmas films that I have been guiltily consuming, although they are now available in various European locally made editions, and they seem to be equally crappy in all languages, which is kind of fun. But since we have a whole audience of people with us here tonight, we thought it'd be fun to ask for some of your recommendations.
Yes, while we've been chatting away, Wojciech has been asking people for their recommendations in the Zoom chat. Wojciech, who would you like to call upon?
Yes, there were a lot of interesting offerings. I decided to go with those that I'm sure are available in English for all of us to consume. So first, I would like to ask Madeline Savitz to talk about the book by Paul Murray titled The Bee Sting.
Hi, thank you.
Hey, Madeline.
It's so good to see you in real life. It really is.
Nice to see you too.
And I'm kind of floored at how many of us there are. But anyway, the Bee Sting was my recommendation. Does anybody know it?
I'm reading it right now, actually. Ooh. Such a coincidence.
Paul Murray, Irish writer. It's kind of a door stopper. What do you think so far, Dominic?
I immediately was hooked. It's such a wonderful, vibrant description of the life of these two teenage girls at the beginning. I was just so into it.
Oh, I hated that mean girl culture.
Oh, really?
But when you move beyond it, plus also I've read a whole lot about Irish provincial life. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, is this going to be another one? No, it's not. And the thing is, it's such an artful blending. It's not about sexual identity per se. We're using these pockets of identity to brand ourselves. And it's another reason not to bond together. And that really struck me. But the themes also of the climate and of nature and of people trying to go against their true nature, their true selves, and how damaging the lack of being true to yourself is, and also the lack of communicating. But the way he does it, man, I was traveling at the time. I had to really just say, no, I'm not going to stay at home and read this book. I'm going to go out.
That good.
And I'm sure it will be made into a film, but that won't do it justice. So,
Can't wait to read this.
I'm hooked.
Yeah, I can't wait to get further.
Do tell us what you think when you finish it.
I will. Yeah, I mean, as you say, it is a real doorstopper, so it's going to take me a while.
He'll be reporting back in 2026. Yeah. Thanks so much, Madeline. Wojciech, who else would you like to call upon?
Yeah, so that was our literature corner. And now some music. Also to celebrate our guest's heritage. Oh my God, I think it was Frank who suggested this jazzstation.be. Could you talk about this a bit?
Yeah, that I was not expecting. Hi.
Hey.
Hi, Frank.
Hi, Frank.
Glad to be here. I live in Brussels and I'm a big jazz nerd. And there's a station that's actually a tiny little old former train station in Brussels, not so far away from the European quarter, actually. And it's called Jazz Station, jazzstation.be. You can see the website. And they've got wonderful concerts of more international artists. You get a very good vibe of the Brussels and the Belgian jazz scene. I recently had concerts between world music and jazz, so it's very open and it's a good vibe. And you meet many jazz students from the conservatory and other places.
Nice.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Next time we're in Brussels, we're going to check it out.
There were a lot of other great ideas. So I think we should post them in the show notes because, you know, we had to do justice to this plethora of great offerings.
Let's do that. Time for a quick happy ending, and for this week's festive episode, I wanted to share the news that Gdansk, a city on the northern coast of Poland, has been awarded the honor of having Europe's best Christmas market, according to an online vote that involved over 750,000 people.
Oh my God.
A huge democratic victory for Gdansk. Although I have to say, when I saw this news, I was immediately suspicious. Some of you will remember from previous episodes of this show that Poland wins quite a lot of these online competitions that are voted on by the public. Right, Wojciech?
Yeah, you're very right. This is like, it seems fishy. So for those who have missed this thing, here at the Europeans for years, we've been following the European Tree of the Year competition. And, you know, it's a competition where every year internet users pick their favorite tree from across Europe. And this year we noticed that since 2022, a Polish tree has come on top every year. Mm-hmm. Even more suspiciously, in 2023, Poland also won the Penguin of the Year competition and the Manul, however that is pronounced, the Manul World Cup, Manul being a breed of very fluffy cats.
Why am I not following that competition religiously already?
I don't know. I think it was great. So this rather unbelievable streak of wins led us to a discovery that two Polish profiles on Instagram with a massive following going into millions of users, they entertained those users, among other things, by mobilizing them to swarm such competitions and win them one by one.
Dirty tricks.
So do you think this all means that Gdansk market is actually not at all special?
Oh no, I think just the opposite. Gdansk is definitely special. It is one of my favorite towns in Poland. And, you know, the history of it is great. It was part of the Hansa. If you just visit Poland, you have to plan a trip to Gdansk because it's really worthwhile. But as a lurker on one of these profiles, indeed, I saw that they encouraged folks to vote for Gdansk. And it's another bit of investigative reporting here. I checked the results and Gdansk won over Romanian Craiova by only 22,000 votes. So it is very likely that this profile's involvement tipped the vote, actually.
Ooh. Whoa. I think maybe we need to get a constitutional court involved to annul this election.
Just not the Romanian one.
Too many annulled elections this week.
Too soon. That said, I read on the website Notes on Poland that the standout feature at this market is a talking moose called Luchek who has witty banter. And that does sound pretty great.
I do like the sound of a talking moose, to be fair. I mean, it does seem like a standout factor that gives Gdansk maybe the edge over the usual European Christmas market offerings, you know, with the hot chocolate and the gingerbread and the mulled wine. Boring. What is a Christmas market without a talking moose? My favorite Christmas market in Europe up until this point has been Regensburg in Germany. But I think I'm going to give Gdansk a try next year. I think we should do a little team trip, everyone.
And in the meantime, I think we need to get these Instagrammers, these Polish Instagrammers who seem to be bending election results, onto the show for an interview.
Show yourselves.
I'll do my best to book them for next year.
Thanks, Wojciech.
That is all that we have time for in this episode, and indeed, all that we have time for in 2024. Thank you so much to everyone who's been here with us for tonight's live recording. It has been a lot of fun. And thank you so much to everyone who has contributed in general to the Europeans this year. And I don't just mean financially. Thank you to everyone who has written in to suggest guests or ideas for future episodes or generally ways that we can make the show better. It is a huge, huge help.
Yes, thank you everyone who's listened, and thank you also to my lovely colleagues on this show. It's so lovely working with you all. I really appreciate it, and I do much less work than the rest of them, so I'm so grateful to them all for making this sound professional, and especially this year, Katie, with her new baby. Thank you so much for everything you've done during this big change in life. This week's episode was produced by Katie Lee, and it's been produced throughout the year by Katz Laszlo, Wojciech Aleksiak, and also the wonderful Morgan Childs in Prague. Thank you so much, everyone.
And thank you for listening. Wishing everyone a peaceful break and a little time to rest and reflect after the crazy year that it's been. We'll be back in January, revived and regenerated. Who knows, maybe after a bracing icy swim. We'll see you then.
Feine Feestdagen.
Adieu.